Saudi Arabia, the U.S. president has made an effort to convince the American public, and the world for that matter, reasons behind why he found it necessary to travel to West Asia and to visit what he has described as a pariah nation, namely Saudi Arabia. His trip will also include Israel, in which he wants to promote its integration into a so-called defense pact with regional countries. While Iran has issued a warning against the Israeli integration, as it's called, we ask if only the U.S. president paid a little time addressing the Khashoggi and Shirin Abu Akhla assassinations, or the deaths of thousands of Yemenis, instead of writing an op-ed filled with inconsistencies on the U.S. role in West Asia or the Middle East. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik joins us. He's an international human rights and labor lawyer who joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Judith Bellow, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement, who joins us from Rochester.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Judith Bellow, if I may. We're looking at this op-ed in particular as explanations given by the U.S. president behind his visit to West Asia. We're focusing in on a couple issues that he raised there in his op-ed. One of them is the fact that he believes that he needs to start what he has called a more promising chapter of America's engagement in this region. He says this trip comes at a vital time and it will advance important American interests. Why does the U.S. think that it needs to be engaged in the West Asia region when the region has moved on, of course, minus Israel?
Well, the United States wants to regain control of the region. And right now they have really critical reasons why they would be, that would be high up on their agenda. For starters, they really, really need the oil, because by turning off the Russian tap for themselves, for us, and for their clients, they have put themselves in a position of having to find oil and gas for not only the United States, but people of Europe and other countries that are actually abiding by the universal unilateral sanctions that the United States has placed on Russia. So, at the moment, it's critical for the United States to regain a connection with Saudi Arabia, and they are looking to restore their control of the Middle East and West Asia, because they feel like they've lost it. They lost the war in Syria. They still have a footprint there, but they certainly didn't win what they hoped to win, and the same is true in Iraq. So, and Yemen is by no means clearly won either. So the United States really has no choice except to regain their connection with their main client in West Asia.
Well, Daniel Kovalik, let me talk in general terms, and then we'll get into more specifics, such as the ones that Judith Bellow talked about. When he writes that he's going to be visiting a region that is more stable and secure than the one that his administration inherited. Maybe one of the reasons why it is that way, if he believes in that, is the fact that he has not been engaged in the region, and perhaps that's why the region, perhaps in some ways, has become more stable and secure.
Well, I certainly think that that is a good supposition. I mean, certainly to the extent the U.S. has been involved in the Middle East in the past decades, it is the one that has sown chaos and instability through its many wars in Iraq, twice, of course, supporting Iraq's attack against Iran, which resulted in an 8 years war, the war in Afghanistan, of course, the support of Saudi Arabia in its war against Yemen. So the U.S. has been the one sowing conflict. I think, though, at the same time, I don't think it's particularly stable right now. The war against Yemen continues. The U.S. continues to occupy a third of Syria. Israel continues to periodically bomb Syria. I think that Lebanon could be on the verge of conflict as well. A war between Israel and Lebanon is a real possibility. So I don't think that it's particularly stable, but I really don't think that Biden's getting involved in the area, particularly via Saudi Arabia, is going to increase the stability.
Well, let's talk about Yemen, Judith Bellows, since you mentioned one of the countries. And he has said that he's proud of the fact that he has named an envoy to engage with leaders across the region, in particular ones with Yemen, of which he said that there's truce that's now in place. The question comes about, if he knew the solution, then why was this not promoted prior? Why did he continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia? Why was he part of the problem and not the solution?
Well, the United States is not only part of the problem, but it's a major driving force in the problem and has always had the power to end that war against Yemen. However, U.S. interests are to have one of their clients control Yemen, either Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. In the meantime, they also have Israel involved through the United Arab Emirates in southern Yemen. And the United States really has not fully engaged with any leadership in Yemen. They're merely expressing talking points so as to sort of chill out their adversaries. However, and they also have to deal with the fact that the war in Yemen is more and more looking like it will be lost in the same sense that the wars in Syria and Iraq were lost. So although the United States can gain some advantage and perhaps occupy a small area, what they can't do is they cannot control this region. And no matter how hard they try, that's been the case. So he can have these bright, happy talking points, but he can't really, he doesn't have personally the power to change any of this. And the United States has the power to stop the conflict, but they don't have the power to achieve their goals in the region.
Why do you think that the United States is not stopping the conflict when it comes to Yemen?
Because they continue to fight for their goals there. It's the same as in Ukraine, actually, where they're willing to fight to the last person in a region to have control rather than allow the conflict to end, and because they don't care what happens to those people. They don't care about the people in the Middle East, and they don't care about the people in Ukraine. They don't care about the people in Syria. The goals are to have control, and they're still somehow thinking that if you have a wasteland, it might be easier to control than if you have a functioning country with a government and objectives and so on. So they're going to keep this up, I believe, until they are resoundingly they've resoundingly lost. In other words, until they are unable so anymore.
Well, I should have asked this question probably in the get-go from the beginning of the program, Daniel Kovalik, but I'm going to need to ask this question as to why the U.S. president, first of all, had an urge or felt there was a need to have an op-ed written in the Washington Post. I'm not too sure if he was told to do that or whether he even wrote it himself or not. What do you think the reason would be? What type of explanation would this have? Because he's making explanations about U.S.'s role, how it has functioned, and what the U.S. is going to do there?
Well, because Saudi Arabia is the elephant in the living room, right? When the U.S. talks about human rights, talks about, you know, the rule of law, talks about the need to respect other countries' sovereignty. Everyone can point to the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia to show the U.S. does none of those things, right? The U.S., by supporting Saudi Arabia, is supporting an undemocratic monarchy that murdered a U.S. journalist in Khashoggi in an embassy, is supporting a country that is engaged in an aggressive war against Yemen. And so all of the U.S.'s claim moral authority in the international arena falls apart immediately when you point to its relationship with Saudi Arabia. And now Biden is going to Saudi Arabia. So, of course, he's trying to put a spin on this to, undermine his critics about the U.S.'s consistent support for this retrograde regime. But I don't think this op-ed's going to help him in that regard because, you know, the proof is in the pudding, they say. Saudi Arabia is not going to change because of this visit. And frankly, I don't think Biden's going to even ask it to.
Well, let's take a look at Israel then, Judith Bello. When you take a look at Israel and some of the explanations that he has given, I'm not too sure who he's trying to convince and whether there are any buyers for it. Like when he says, in Israel, we helped end a war in Gaza, which could have easily have lasted months in just 11 days. And then just a few sentences later, we passed the largest support package for Israel, over $4 billion in history.
Well, the hypocrisy of the United States with regard to Israel is so overwhelming. Pardon me for laughing, but it's just so bizarre and so outside of any connection to reality that it's hard to take it seriously. And I think this is a big problem for the United States right now. And it goes back to your question that you asked Daniel, which is why he wrote the or why somebody wrote the op-ed, because I doubt if it was the president. However, the American people are, you know, you can't cover up anymore the awfulness of Israel, and that's true also of Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia left out of the list of their crudities is the fact that women have no power over anything there. They have no freedom there. So when you look at Israel, the abuses that Israel perpetuates are no longer being covered up as easily as they were even 10 or 20 years ago. And young people who are born now, young people, that war that created Israel is ancient history. They have no knowledge of it and no particular interest in it. They actually see what's happening right now. You can't hold up the quote-unquote Holocaust and say, okay, there's nothing beyond that anymore, mm-hmm. because the young people don't have any connection with it at all. Their grandparents and great grandparents might, but for them it's a non-starter. It's a curtain that's no longer opaque. So the United States government has to continually keep reminding people that our allies are good people. And that we need to relate to them because we can help them be better people, and they can help us have the things we need. And this is not going to because of the torn curtain, this is not working anymore. And so mm-hmm. they're having to work harder and harder at it.
The couple of issues that comes to mind when we talk about Israel, I'm not going to even ask about this Daniel Kovalik when it comes to Israeli rights violations in the occupied territories, because it's happening on so many different areas and on an almost daily basis. But I have to ask about the assassination of the Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Why was this op-ed not have her name included in any sense, or for it to even be on the agenda? Because it is something that is really a big deal, and it resonated across the world from the reaction of what happened. Why do you think that was not one of the talking points?
Well, for precisely the reason you say, there's no way to put a good spin on that. I mean, that is evidence of Israel's complete disregard for human rights, for the rights of the Palestinian people. It shows Israel is a rogue state. And so Biden just simply ignored it in his talking points. Again, because there's no way to justify it. There's no way to claim it didn't happen. And so he's going to pretend it didn't happen. And this, of course, is how the U.S. handles Israel's crimes all the time. It just pretends they don't happen and hopes that people will look away and not pay attention. And it's worked for a long time, and hopefully it's going to stop working.
The point that is very critical here about this visit and has been heavily criticized by Iran is, Judith Bello, the integration that the U.S. president wants to make between Israel, the forging of security and defense cooperation between Israel and Saudi Arabia and Arab countries. Of course, Saudi Arabia has not come out like some of the other Persian Gulf countries and formally formalized a relationship with Israel, even though behind the scenes it is said that they have had one. And this is due to mainly because of what they have, the U.S. has said, is a perceived Iranian threat. Why is there a perceived Iranian threat thought so by the U.S. when it is, for example, Israel that has been attacking Syria, that Israel has assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists and destroyed parts of one of our nuclear facilities here in the Islamic Republic?
Well, the United States needs Israeli aggression, and they need to maintain the Saudis' capability for aggression as well, because they appear to be planning a world war. And where the lines are going to break down is that Iran and Syria are going to be on the other side, whereas Israel is definitely a U.S. ally. And Saudi Arabia really might be moved to the other side when you're talking about lining up your pieces on the chessboard. And they need to have Saudi Arabia in our camp. They need to have someone over there who will manage the Saudis. And they're thinking that Israel could do that. They've always, the reason for Israel's existence is because they want an entity there that will manage the Middle East for them, what they call the Middle East for them in West Asia. So the Israel-Saudi connection needs to be made, and it needs to be made strongly. And having got the Emirates to become open about it and Qatar, they have a shot at pushing the Saudis in that direction as well. And especially because they are referring to Mohammed bin Salman as a quote-unquote modernizer and a progressive president in Saudi Arabia, which is anything but the case. The problem is these are U.S. tools in the world war, which is already beginning. And because we live over here in the United States, we don't see it. It hasn't come to us. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people who feel like it never will. But in my opinion, the way they're pushing it right now, they're running a high risk of really creating something that will go far beyond anything they've done in the past. And I feel very sad to have to note that, because they should have stopped a long time ago. They shouldn't have hurt those people that they're already hurting. Mm-hmm. So it's really a very bad situation, and the United States is culpable in creating a situation of violence and vicious economic situation.
Sure.
That is hurting people all over the world.
Well, Danny Kovalik, our guest from Rochester there, talked about how the Saudis may have even moved on, in a sense. I mean, maybe they're not going to receive the U.S. president's and help him attain the goals that it's after, because we're looking at well, what is there to gain for the Saudis? I mean, I'm certain it doesn't take rocket scientists to figure out that they're enjoying the more than $100 a barrel of oil that they're making money on. And at this point, they have not really pushed themselves to produce more oil or to lead other countries of perhaps OPEC to do that. And there are even reports that Saudi Arabia can't even produce any more oil at this point anyways. It's really tapped out. It's doing what it can. So why should Saudi Arabia listen to Joe Biden? What is in it for them?
Well, that's the real question, isn't it? And that's what should be of concern to people. That is to say, Biden's not going there to tell Saudi Arabia to behave. Biden's going there hat in hand to beg for Saudi Arabia to do more to get oil prices down. He has no leverage over them. He's going to make a deal with them, which means giving them more latitude in the war in Yemen, more latitude to cause trouble in the Arab world. And so I think that, you know, you raise the right question. So I think we're going to see the U.S. give more to the Saudis rather than ask more of them.
So if that's the case, if what we're looking at, Judith Bellow, is what is the U.S. going to give the Saudis in order to convince them, how can there then be this incentive for the Saudis and Israelis to integrate or for them to unite and to come out and make that formal declaration, in a sense? Because the Saudis have not done that up to this point. Many people have said that they would have before, but it still hasn't happened.
Well, the Saudis, they have a lot of risk, actually, in making that a public relationship, because the people of Saudi Arabia and the people of the region at large are highly opposed to it. And they're very hostile to Israel, and for good reason. And this is true in Iran as well. People are hostile because Israel is attacking them. So the United States really, it's kind of interesting. They're sending Biden over hat in hand, as Daniel said, to beg. But what they want is something they may or may not have enough resources to achieve. Because only in the last few weeks, Russia and China have both been over there as well and making their offers. And so the Saudis are going to lay out the pieces on the table, and they're going to say, I have this offer here. It's like, you know, the grooms lining up, the potential grooms lining up for a wedding. They're going to say, well, this guy offers this much, and he's going to take that much. And this guy offers that much, and he demands that much. And they're going to have to make a decision on who to align with. And this is not a good scene for the United States. And it shows, because they even went down and went begging to Venezuela. In Venezuela, they stole billions of dollars from them. They've let the people there starve. How dare they go and ask? But
okay,
this is going to be a hard win with
Saudi
Arabia.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Let me thank Judith Bellow, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement, and Daniel Kovalik, thank you. Human rights, labor rights lawyer, spoke to us there from Pittsburgh, PA. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran is guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وما يأتيهم من ذكر من الرحمن محدث إلا كانوا عنه معرضين
And no revelation comes to them anew from the Most Merciful except that they turn away from it.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the fourth verse of chapter Shu'ara. إِنَّ شَأْنُ نَزِّلْ عَلَيْهِمْ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ آيَةِ فَظَلَّتْ أَعْنَاقُهُمْ لَهَا خَالِعِينَ If we please, we should send down upon them a sign from the heaven to which they would bend their necks in humility. The fifth verse says, وَمَا يَأْتِيهِمْ مِنْ ذِكْرٍ مِنَ الرَّحْمَنِ مُحْدَثٍ إِلَّا كَانُوا عَنْهُ مُعْرِضِينَ And never comes there to them a new reminder from the beneficent Allah, but they turn away from it. We said that the Almighty Allah is completely sympathizing with the Holy Prophet after mentioning the third verse that addressing the Holy Prophet says, you're about to kill yourself with grief. And now the Holy Quran says, إِنَّ شَأْنُ نَزِّلْ عَلَيْهِمْ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ آيَةِ But our way of treatment and law is to provide people with choice and options, and faith cannot be compulsorily achieved. So we give them options and respite. Now, in this verse, the position of pagans and polytheists against the Holy Quran is mentioned. It says, وَمَا يَأْتِيهِمْ مِنْ ذِكْرٍ مِنَ الرَّحْمَنِ مُحْدَثٍ إِلَّا كَانُوا عَنْهُ مُعْرِضِينَ Never comes there to them a new reminder from the beneficent Allah, but they turn away from it. Using the Quranic word dhikr and reminder is referring to the fact that all verses, all the chapters and surahs of the Holy Quran are striking man's conscience. They somehow give him awareness. They are trying to awake him. But this group, this polytheist, turn away from vigilance and awareness. And interestingly, these verses are sent down out of his general mercy. وَمَا يَأْتِيهِمْ مِنْ ذِكْرٍ مِنَ الرَّحْمَنِ Using this word, الرَّحْمَن, the beneficent, is referring to this matter that these verses are sent down out of his general mercy. He calls all people, without exception. He wants all the people to be invited to happiness and perfection. That is why the verse says, مَا يَأْتِيهِمْ مِنْ ذِكْرٍ مِنَ الرَّحْمَنِ This kind of reminder is from someone who is الرَّحْمَن, all-beneficent. But it is also likely that this is mentioned for motivating people to thank Allah, because these words are said by Allah, whose blessings embrace people. How they turn away from Him, their creator, their benefactor. And if He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, does not hurry to punish them, it is because of His mercy too. وَمَا يَأْتِيهِمْ مِنْ ذِكْرٍ مِنَ الرَّحْمَنِ
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن فيه أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So, the verse says, وَمَا يَأْتِيهِمْ مِنْ ذِكْرٍ مِنَ الرَّحْمَنِ مُهْدِثٍ. Never comes to them a new reminder from the Beneficent, إِلَّا كَانُوا عَنْهُ مُعْرِضِينَ. But they turn away from it. The Arabic word muhdith means new and fresh. This word is used to refer to the matter that the verses of the Holy Quran are sent down one after another, and each of these words has a new concept, has a new meaning and kind of understanding in it. But the point is, what benefit it has that they are against these fresh truths, as if they have had perpetual relationship with those superstitions of the ancestors. They do not want to say farewell to the ignorance of them. They do not want to part with their superstitions and misleading at any given price. Stubborn and unwise people are always against any new thing, though it may guide and inform and somehow save them. This is exactly what the Holy Quran in chapter Mu'minun says. Have they not pondered the statement of the Quran, or has anything come to them that did not come to their fathers of old? So they struggle with it because it is new. أَفَلَمْ يَدَّبَّرُوا الْقَوْلِ أَمْ جَاءَهُمْ مَا لَمْ يَأْتِ أَبَاءَهُمُ الْأَوَّلِينَ, the Holy Quran says. So the human beings should not rely on their ancestors and previous sunnahs and traditions. They have to be flexible. When they hear something new, when they see a new sign, they, in the first step, should not try to turn their faces away from the truth. You have to expose yourself to the truth, and eventually you will be guided. But if you try to put yourself away from the truth, even the best kind of prophet with the best kind of miracle is not enough for you to be guided. وَمَا يَأْتِيهِمْ مِنْ ذِكْرٍ مِنَ الرَّحْمَنِ مُحْدَثٍ إِلَّا كَانُوا عَنْهُ مُعْرِضِينَ. They turned away from it. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. Just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Absana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
After 2 years of waiting for the Hajj, caravans of pilgrims and lovers of the sacred house of God have converged on Mecca. Nearly 40,000 Iranian pilgrims were also among the 850,000 foreign pilgrims who have visited Saudi Arabia for 2022 Hajj. Many of them have been waiting for years for their turn.
After 17 years of waiting, I was able to visit this holy place, and I hope all Iranians could one day travel to this sacred land.
I've traveled to Mecca after 15 years of waiting, and I hope all Muslims' wishes come true.
Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, most of them for over a decade. And this year, Saudi-imposed restrictions on the Hajj pilgrimage have dealt a blow to many Iranians' hopes. Ministry of Hajj and Umrah barred pilgrims under the age of 65 from participating in the Hajj. Also, pilgrims must be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 and have a negative coronavirus test before leaving for the kingdom. Those who have had the chance to be next to the Holy Kaaba, however, haven't forgotten others.
We are very happy to be on this spiritual journey and ask God to give all those who want to be here the chance to do so.
The only wish I can make in this holy place is well-being and redemption for all Muslims.
Right now, I'm standing in the middle of the holiest place on the planet for all Muslims, the Grand Mosque in Mecca, next to the Holy Kaaba. And I intend to perform tawaf on behalf of all Muslims who have to wait at least for another year to get the chance to visit their sacred place.
Nahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
The road to Lysychansk, the most recent city taken by the Russians, it's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. It's the small settlement of Toshkivka. There's so much destruction, it's uninhabitable. One of a few villages we pass that may, quite literally, be wiped off the map. Now, we're on the road to Lysychansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour. The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight, although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting.
I went outside and saw a car driving with the letter Z on it, and there was a pro-Russian militia guy. He climbed up there, took off the Ukrainian flag, and hung the Russian flag, the flag of victory. And our joy began. People came to see the flag, and they were happy. They were crying, laughing, and dancing. It was great, and I still feel this joy. I think it'll remain with me forever.
A statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II. Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control.
When it was Ukraine here, we lived, somehow. There were several incidents, like my wife owned a small hairdresser's. Once a man from some nationalist battalion came and made her speak Ukrainian. He was shouting and even kicked her. They took me away for questioning a few times. It was Ukrainization here. I'm Russian, and I was born here. They were trying to force us to assimilate.
They consider people here in Donbas subhuman. I always wondered whether we had horns or something. We were second-class citizens. One Ukrainian soldier who was born only 50 kilometers away from me asked me why I hadn't left to Russia. They told us all the time to leave. But why? I've lived here all my life. My parents died here. My daughter lives here. He told me I was pro-Russian and so I should leave. They treat us with hatred.
The Russian army has set up a museum on the street. Tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lisichansk.
Touting South Korea's nuclear technology to allies at a recent summit in Europe, President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's nuclear energy production and boost reactor sales abroad. The previous administration began to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, problems with South Korea's aging reactors, and industry corruption. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's decision to reverse course and ramp up nuclear power comes as the country faces multiple challenges to meeting its energy requirements. South Korea imports almost 100% of its oil, leaving it open to costly crude price fluctuations. And rising temperatures have increased energy demand here to record levels. The government will resume suspended reactor construction, with nuclear generating 30% of the country's energy mix by 2030. The Yoon administration says the move will help the country reach carbon neutrality and create jobs. Environmentalists decry the policy turnabout.
Nuclear technology is inherently risky, and it's also expensive, and also it's not a good solution for climate change.
South Korea ranks last in the OECD in renewable energy production, such as solar, wind, and geothermal, which activists view as offering viable alternatives.
To replace fossil fuels without increasing nuclear and provide all the electricity need with the renewables, that's a challenge. But based on the analysis from the governmental institutions, the renewable energy potential for South Korea is enough to provide all the electricity we need.
South Korea plans to export 10 nuclear reactors by 2030, currently vying for projects planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. Officials also this week announced funding for new small modular reactor, SMR, development. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After decades of fighting, victims and the families of those impacted by the Factor VIII blood contamination scandal could be headed for compensation of sorts. In one of the darkest periods for Britain's National Health Service, a shortage of clotting agents for haemophiliacs and others suffering from other blood disorders meant the country imported blood products from the US. It later emerged the blood had been distilled from a wide range of people, including prisoners, and had been poorly screened. An investigation led by former judge Sir Brian Langstaff was announced by ex-Prime Minister Theresa May back in 2017 and seems to be finally approaching its conclusion. Earlier this month, one of the ministers at the centre of the scandal, John Major, was forced to apologise after saying the victims had incredibly bad luck. Major had previously written that it was unwise to give a sympathetic view to the victims, as this might open the government up to culpability, a view that disgusts those still working with patients.
Even more damaging than the actual medical error itself, and you know, I'm a doctor, I've been involved in medical error, it's an inevitable part of life and an inevitable part of medical practice, but the attitude towards that transparency and honesty and admission of mistakes to prevent further harm being done is at the heart of good medical ethics. And what we see here is at the highest governmental level, an open admission that there was knowledge, but action wouldn't be taken either to acknowledge the error, to take steps to stop further people being infected, perhaps. And certainly, at the heart of all of this was the worry about money.
Due to medical advances and the more robust fashion in which blood products are screened before even getting to the patient, the likelihood of another Factor VIII scandal is highly unlikely. But according to experts, the race to weaken the NHS means another health crisis is just around the corner.
Representatives of the current government have pledged to abide by the results and recommendation of the probe. But for many of those affected and the loved ones they've left behind, anything will be too little, too late. Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip are preparing for Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, amid dire economic conditions. The sacred Muslim occasion comes at the end of the Hajj season, and it will be observed in Palestine on Saturday. Gazans have been observing Eid al-Adha under a tight Israeli siege since 2007. Muslims around the world buy new clothes, special gifts, and sweets for the loved ones on this festive occasion, but most Gazans can't afford such luxury.
We're trying to make our children happy during Eid, but things are really tough. Most of us are just going around the markets unable to afford Eid gifts for our families. The economic situation is very bad and has been getting worse by the year due to the blockade.
People are seen browsing the merchandise lining the streets and sidewalks of Gaza and hardly buying anything. They shop for long hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
During the holidays before the blockade, I used to buy a lot of clothes and gifts for my children, but nowadays I just buy them a few things. I have been coming to the market for 3 days now, trying to find something that I can afford.
According to UN figures, some 80% of Gazans depend on humanitarian aid to survive. Experts say the Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has devastated Gaza's economy and worsened the living conditions.
The Israeli blockade has been in place for a very long time and is the main reason for the weak purchasing power during Eid al-Adha. The majority of people in Gaza have a limited income, and more than 60% of the population suffers from poverty and unemployment. People are having a very hard time during the holidays, and they can hardly afford to put food on the table.
All happy occasions in this impoverished territory have been marred by the blockade and Israeli atrocities in recent years.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing themselves for Eid al-Adha holiday, despite the dire straits facing them due to the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's plan to deregulate the sector. The industrial action was called by a string of unions representing cab drivers in opposition to Article 10 of a competition bill linked to the reforms the EU requires in exchange for the funding of Italy's post-COVID National Recovery and Resilience Fund. Unionists say that the regulation will open cab drivers up to unfair competition from web-based ride-sharing services.
A law that regulates our sector was already approved 3 years ago, and the EU doesn't require further amendments. Taxi fares are presently regulated by local authorities. Prices would go ballistic if we let the privates take over. A deregulation would favour multinationals over independent drivers. Full stop.
On Monday, a protest called by unionists in Rome's central quarters led to disruption to traffic and buses in the Italian capital. The demonstration ended up in clashes with police. On Tuesday, tens of cab drivers gathered at Rome's municipality, asking local authorities to take their side. Protests were also held in Milan and other Italian cities.
Like taxi drivers across the European Union, Italy's licensed cabbies have been protesting ever since private hired services such as Uber arrived on the scene in 2014. An endless series of strikes and protests against the liberalization of the sector have been staged over the years.
This government works for the almighty dollar, that's it. We are in the midst of an unprecedented economic crisis, and what does the executive do? It gives multinationals more privileges. What about us, the people?
Tension within the broad coalition supporting Prime Minister Mario Draghi's government was high over the competition bill until not long ago. However, a split in the once anti-establishment five-star movement, with Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio embracing Draghi's more pro-market views, seems to have calmed down the churning waters of Italian politics. Max Civili, Rome.
Tehran, the capital of Iran, and now a destination for investors. Tehran Investment Summit brought together businesses, mayors, and urban development officials from Iran and the world to explore areas of investment in Tehran.
It's so important for us to participate in here, and we consider as a not only for a relationship between two cities, it's in the, including for the relationship between two countries.
2 years ago, the Iranian and Nicaraguan capitals, Tehran and Managua, signed an MOU that named them as sister cities. Now, with the Tehran Investment Summit, there is a chance for Managua to further cooperate with Tehran in launching urban development projects.
210 projects covering waste management, transport, and tourism, among others, will be introduced to investors in the two-day conference. The projects total roughly $71 billion. Tehran municipality says if those projects are accomplished, they will revolutionize the Iranian capital.
This is the start of a turning point in Tehran's development. This conference was inaugurated today, but it has no closing ceremony. The exhibition section of the event will continue to run permanently to highlight any area that needs investment. This will transform Tehran's future.
Being among the busiest cities means that Tehran is inevitably among the most polluted places in the world. Municipal authorities say they also welcome any investment in controlling air pollution in Tehran.
Eliminating air pollution and traffic congestions are among the major challenges in Tehran, which can be solved permanently through the promotion of clean transportation. I'm certain that many investors would love to invest in this area.
Attracting foreign investment has long been a challenge for Iran as a result of U.S. sanctions that restrict global banking transactions with Iran.
I would not say that sanctions will not affect foreign investment, but we are focusing on the private sector, which acts separately from governments. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Iran has also promised to support foreign investors should they take part in Tehran's development projects.
Life in the Iranian capital is a mixed experience of modernity and antiquity, as it's home to both skyscrapers and historic buildings, together making it a hot tourist target. But tourism is only one of the countless capacities for investment in Tehran, as it's home to some 15 million residents, and with a large population comes a wide array of interests and businesses. As the capital of Iran, Tehran has numerous opportunities for investors, from tourism to transport and pollution control projects. Many of those projects have so far been running based on citizen participation or tax revenues. Now, Tehran municipality says with its approach shifting toward investment, the development of the metropolis is expected to accelerate. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In the limelight.
Without wild species, our whole planet unravels, said one scientist in response to new UN-backed report. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Biodiversity Destruction Imperils Natural Species Crucial to Humanity's Survival. Stay tuned for more. A new report backed by the UN warned recently that humans must ramp up efforts to sustainably use and protect the world's flora and fauna to avoid the extinction of thousands of species which billions of people rely on for survival every day, whether they know it or not. After more than 4 years of preparation by 85 experts from around the world, drawing from scientific data as well as indigenous people's knowledge, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, IPBES, released its report showing that people across the globe depend on 50,000 wild plant and animal species for food, energy, medicine, and other purposes.
Pablo Pacheco, an author of the report and a scientist at the Worldwide Fund for Nature, said, "Without wild species, our whole planet unravels," adding, "Billions of people